And we're holding on page Samach Hey in Sanhedrin, the fifth line. We started learning about Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, the whole story of how Nebuchadnezzar set up that gigantic statue of his and ordered that everybody should bow to it, and Hanani, Mishael, Azariah didn't, and they were thrown into the fiery furnace, and then they were saved from it. So, more details about that. The Gemara says, Tonet Ve Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. We learn in a braisa from the yeshiva of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Afilu b'shasa sakona, even when a person is in time of danger, lo yishana odem asatzme min harabonis shaloi. A person should not vary from his usual rabbonis. Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, up until now, had been government ministers. To begin with, when they and Daniel had been brought to Nebuchadnezzar's court, was so that they should be trained to be able to serve in his court. So now they were wearing their fancy clothes of office, and when they were thrown into, when they were ordered to come in front of Nebuchadnezzar, and he starts yelling at them, how could you not be bowing to my statue? They wore the same honorable clothing that they always did, and then they were thrown into the fire with it as well. And the idea behind it, Rashi says this way: he shouldn't appear like he's afraid and embarrassed, and then in terror from his enemies. Also, Maharsha says another point, because like this, he may be facing Din Shamayim, he's going to be facing a judgment from Hashem. They didn't know they're going to come out of this alive after all. So a person should be accepting it ba'avo, the simcha, in an honorable way, and therefore he shouldn't be coming there wearing sackcloth or whatever. He should be coming wearing his rabbonus, his big day rabbonus, his honorable clothing, to show that, as Rashi says, that he's not afraid of the enemies, and as Maharshal says, to show that he's not questioning Hashem's judgment, he's not troubled over Hashem's judgment. Shenema, as we find by Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, they dying Guvraya Ilach, at that time, these men, Kfisu, they were tied up, the Sarbalehen, and they were wearing their Sarbalehen, which is a type of robe, Pachehen, their pants, the Kabbaloshen, and their hats, Vagomer, and they were thrown into the fire. Different Mephoshim have different understandings of what exactly these clothing are, but the point is that they were wearing their fancy clothing, their regular honorable clothing, as ministers of the king, rather than something cheaper. And we have many examples of that in history where even regular Jews, let alone Rabbanim, went on Mesiras Nefesh in full big day Rabbanus, and then the whole nine yards, they're not gonna take off, they're not gonna put on something cheaper or whatever in fear, or like to kowtow in front of the goyim. Well, there she's coming to flee with the Hashverosh, so it's not quite the same thing. But yeah, I mean, you have, take for example, you know, when the Friedrich Kadeva was arrested, he writes over there, you know, he made up right away, he's not going to be afraid of them, he's not going to show the slightest bit of obeisance to anything they order him around to do, even when one of them, for example, says, I'll take your bag, after all, my Zeta carried a bag for your Zeta, and the Friedrich Kadeva immediately takes it back from him and says, nothing doing, your Zeta went with mine to go where my Zeta wanted, you want the other way around, you know, you're not doing it, I'm not following you, and you have many examples like that. You have many other examples with Gdoli Yisrael. One interesting one they bring in the art scroll in Yaakov, they give an example that Reb Shimon Schwab, Olav HaShalom, was in the 30s, he was a rov in a town in Germany, and at one point he was accused of saying something in one of his drushes against Hitler, Yamach Shemai, whatever. There was a period of time when he was in great danger any time they might come and arrest him. So for a period of time, they say he actually slept in his clothing with his rekel, with his rabbanishad rekel nearby. This way, if they do come in the middle of the night to arrest him, he can go there dressed as a rov should be. Onward. Amar Rav Yechanan, Gedolim Tzadikim Yosmim Malachi Ashores. We can also see from this story that Tzadikim are greater than Malachi Ashores. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Onei Va'omar, so Nebuchadnezzar all of a sudden sees them walking around in the fire. How is that? Onei Va'omar, he called out and he said, Ho Anochose Gubrin Arba, here I see four men, Shrayin, and they're untied, Malachin Begoy Nura, they're walking around in the fire. V'chol chavol, or v'chavol is actually how it says in the pasuk. V'chavol lo isai b'hon, and there's not the slightest injury to them. V'revei didiri ah, domei levare lekin. And the appearance of the fourth one appears like a bar lekin, which means a malach. By the way, when we learned, so what it means is, originally there were three, there's Hanani, Mishael, Azariah thrown in there, so where does the fourth one come in? Is a malach. But the fact that he describes the malach as the fourth one, implying like he's walking behind them, implies that the Malach is subservient to them because they, as Tzadikim, are greater than him. you know, in many ways, we talk about human beings are not anywhere near the level of malachim. We have the example, for example, that most of the year we have to say Baruch Shem Kvod Malchus Elanavod quietly, but so to speak, Moshe stole it from the malachim, and therefore we can't use it openly. But the point is, when a yid goes, when a yid goes like they did on Mesiras Nefesh, and a yid goes, and then ala torah ala avoda, and he's a malachim after all, are described as ha'umdim ha'ela. They stand still, whatever, however the Eibishter created them. That's their their teva, and they can't change from it, as opposed to a person is able to go and transcend their teva, and therefore in that sense they can be higher than a malach. And therefore we see the malach as like subservient to them and walking behind them. The Gemara tells us in Pesachim, by the way, what happened was when they're being thrown into the fire, the Malach of Hail comes to the Eibishter and proposes, you know, I'm the Malach of Hail, which is ice. Let me go down there and cool them and then make it hail and put out the fire. And Gavriel says, no, but then that won't be such an obvious ness. Instead, I'm the Malach of Fire. I'll go down there. I'll cool off the fire for them so they can walk around in it comfortably and heat up the fire even more on the outside, as we learned last time, that four whole nations and their ministers or whatever were burnt by it, and that way it'll be nest the safe nest. So it'll be a nest inside a nest. So that fourth person walking around with them, that is Malach Gavriel. By the way, the Medrash also says on it, so like this, Nebuchadnezzar calls him Bar Elikim, which literally means a son of Hashem. So fine, we find sometimes Bnei Elikim is used an expression in Psukim to mean Malachim, but still, you know, a Goy, an Ovid Abedazara, like Nebuchadnezzar, you can imagine what he's thinking when he says Bar Elikim. So Medrash says that actually, in the same way as we learned last time, that a Malach came and slapped him to stop him praising Hashem more than he's supposed to. So here also, a Malach gives him a slap on the mouth. What do you think, Hashem has a son? Don't talk like that.
What? 2,000 years before.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't 2,000, but 500, 400, 500 years before Osir-ish. But yeah. Okay. Onward. At that point, when Hanani Mishor Vazariah came out alive from this fiery furnace, Bokol Umasa Olam, all the nations, all the Goyish nations came, V'tofchul Sinein Sho Yisrael Alpneim, and they were hitting and slapping Sinein Sho Yisrael in their faces, which is the Gemara's usual euphemism for the Jewish people themselves. So they were all coming and humiliating and slapping the Jews. Amr Lahem, they're telling them, they're telling them, Yesh lachem alekakazeh, you have a God who's so great like that, the Atamishtachim Matzelem, and you all bowed to the statue. In other words, because we have to understand, there were other Jews there besides Hanani Mishael Vazaliah as well. It's not like everybody in the empire could be expected to come, but everybody who's in any kind of position of leadership was being ordered to come and bow. And everybody bowed down except Hanani Mishael Vazaliah. So now the Goyim are telling them, how you talking that you bowed to a statue like that when you have such a great God? We talked about the other day, and the point that Rishonim discussed, was the statue even of a deserter or not? If it was actual outright Avodah Zarah, then we can understand what the Goyim are harassing the Jews about. If we say it wasn't even really technically Avodah Zarah, then it's a little harder to understand what they're saying, but still, maybe they're saying that with that, you shouldn't even be bowing to a statue in honor of the king. Anyway. Miyad poskuv amru, right away they started saying, and who's the they is Mefoshim explained that this is Hanani Mishael Vazariah themselves said. They used the Loshan Apostle, which later on Daniel used in his tefillah, L'cha Hashem Atzdaka V'lonu Boshes Aponim Kayem Azeh. Hashem, yours is the righteousness, and to us is the embarrassment, the shamefacedness, as of this day, meaning on this day when you saved Hanani Mishael Vazariah from the fire, and all the goyim are mocking us. You're right. L'cha Hashem Atzdaka. You Hashem have the tzedakah that you saved these tzaddikim, and we have the shamefacedness that now the goyim are humiliating us to our faces that we ever bowed to the statue in the first place. As it is, the Goyim continued to worship Avodah Zarah for hundreds of years after that. One idea is, they're saying, you have a great God like that, so they're saying, for you, it's beneath your dignity, but for ourselves, they figured it's fine for us to continue doing it. It took a long time afterwards, and even now, it's not completely gone, that they still believe in their Genshkas. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Amar Rav Yonasan, my dichtiv, what does it mean in this connection? You have a pasuk in Shir Hashirim. Amarti, Hashem says, personified, Elev summer, I would climb up on the palm tree, I would grab a hold of its clusters of its branches or its clusters of dates. So what does that mean? Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ani Amarti El B'Somer Eri Yisrael. I thought that I would be elevated by means of the tomer, the palm tree, which represents the Jewish people. Rashi refers to a Gemara in Sukkah that points out that a palm tree, unlike most trees, don't have lev echad. They don't have a single heart in the sense that you have the trunk itself contains growth wings, and you have the branches also contain. And there's not really a noticeable difference between wood that comes from the trunk versus of the branches. They're all the same in that regard. As opposed to a palm tree, you have the substance of which the trunk is made out of. The branches are something else entirely. The branches are of a palm tree are completely dissimilar on the inside to the trunk of the tree. For that matter, the trunk itself. Again, most trees have growth rings. A palm tree does not. You cut open a palm tree, you cut down a palm tree, you won't see any growth rings over there. So in that sense, it has lev echad, has one unique heart. Therefore, that represents the Jewish people who have one heart turned to the Eibishter. So now I thought that they're going to be Makadosh, Shem Shemayim, and I would be elevated and raised up through all of them. But now Hashem says, instead of being able to go up through the Tomer as a whole, instead, Oichazav Sansina, that grabbed a hold of its branches, meaning, V'achshav, like Ola B'yodi, of a Sansan Echad, Shachanani Mishal V'azalya. Now in the event, I was only able to grab a hold of one branch represented by Chanani Mishal V'azalya, because everybody else bowed to the statue and only they held firm. What happened to Daniel, by the way, we're going to talk about soon. Why wasn't Daniel involved in the whole story? We'll get to that soon. But in any case, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah were the only ones who were there and did not bow to him. So therefore, in that passage, Hashem is expressing kind of a disappointment. I expected better of the Jewish people. Veni Hoyoda points out, you know, we just talked about that what happened to Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah was Nes, the Seich Nes. Well, therefore, he says that's the word San Son, is the same letter as we arranged. Nun Samach, Nun Samach. Yeah. Amar Rav Yechanan, and then the Gemara continues, Amar Rav Yechanan says, my dichtiv, here's another pasuk that's relevant to this. The Navi Zechariah, who lived at the Navi Zechariah was one of the Nevi'im at the beginning of the second Mishnah. So he has, in the first part of his Sefer, which is part of Tere Yasser, he has a whole bunch of symbolic visions that he saw. So now he says, well, he describes one of them. Ro'isi Halayla, he says, I saw the night. And behold, there was a man riding on a red horse. And he was standing among the hadassim that were growing in the swamp, in the lowlands. The achrav, and following him, susim adumim srukim levanim. Following him, there were other horses that were red and srukim, which is patchy colors, levanim, and white horses. So what does all this represent? So my Ra'isi Halayla, so let's start with what he means when he says, I saw the night. Now, part of the question is the fact, for example, it says Ra'isi Halayla is a bit of an unusual expression. Ra'isi Balayla or something, I saw at night. Ra'isi Halayla, I saw the night. What is he seeing? What is he seeing night? Also, the Rif points out over here, if he's riding on a horse, Ra'isi also saw them, then what's Ra'hu Oymed Ben Hadassim? What's he standing among the Hadassim? He's either standing or riding. So my Ra'isi Halayla means Bikash HaKadosh Baruch Hu Latachas Kol Ha'olam Kulei L'Layla. There came a point when Hashem was thinking of Kaviyachol of turning the whole world back into night, namely because they had bowed down to the Selim, and therefore by that they had failed to make a Kiddush Hashem and made in fact the opposite of Big Chil Hashem. Vehine ish roichiv, and when the pasuk continues, there was a man riding. Ein ish ala HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The word ish in this kind of context means Hashem. Shenema Hashem ish melchama, Hashem shemoy. Hashem is described in the pasuk as a man of war, so to speak. Hashem is his name. So he's riding al sus adam on a red horse, which means also that there was disaster coming. Bikash HaKadosh Baruch Hu lafach kol ha'olam kulo l'dam. Hashem was intending to turn the entire world into blood, that there would be a huge amount of bloodshed as a result of people bowing down to the Tzelem. But then, Kivin Shinistako Hanani Mishael v'Azariah, but then Hashem looked at Hanani Mishael v'Azariah, who was tzaddikim, and who stood fast when everybody else didn't, Niskanera Daito, then Hashem, so to speak, calmed down and felt better. Shenema, that's why the pasuk continues, Ruhu Oymed Ben Hadassim Asher Bamatzola, that he's standing among the Hadassim that are in the lowlands, in the swamp. So what does that mean? Vein hadassim el tzaddikim. The word hadassim specifically refers to tzaddikim. Shenema, as we find by Esther, right? He oymen es hadassah. So we see that she was called Hadassah. Maharsha points out that actually the Gemara in Megillah takes a different view of it. That it's the other. The Gemara has several different opinions over there. We know she was called Esther. We know she was also called Hadassah. And the Gemara has a few different opinions over there. Which one was her real name versus which one was a nickname given for the event? So one opinion is that her real name was Esther, and then she was called Hadassah because she was a tzaddikus. And then you have this pasuk for who I mean by Hadassim. So like in each place, the Gemara is using the other pasuk as a proof that tzaddikim are compared to Hadassim.
But the Hadassah is a different plant than the leaves of the Tamar.
No, that was before. We had two different analogies. Right. First, we analogized the Jewish people to a palm tree and Hanani Mishra Bazari to one branch of it that Hashem was elevated through. Now we're saying like a lulav, yeah. Now we're saying a different point that tzaddikim also compared to Hadassim. One point is also the idea of comparing the Jewish people to a palm tree in that connection is also the palm tree is very tall and straight, representing how Hanani Mishael Bar Azariah stood tall and straight and wouldn't bow down to the statue when everybody else did. Meanwhile, now we're saying a different metaphor of it that said that tzaddikim are also compared to Hadassim, which have a beautiful fragrance. So again, we see that they're called Hadassim over here, and we see that Esther is called Hadassah for the same reason. The in Metzula El Abovel, and the word Metzula, the lowlands, the swamp, refers to Bavel, Shenemar, as the Pasuk says. Hashem says, Ha'omer Latzula Charavi, Hashem says to Tzula, to the lowlands, to Bavel, Charavi, dry up. Bavel was famous for its canals and its water sources, so now Hashem says, you're going to be destroyed, you're going to be dried up. V'nare Sayich Oivish, and I will dry up your rivers. So we see that Bavel is called Metzula. Elsewhere, the Gemara points out, for example, that because it's very low-lying after the marble, that was where everything drained out to there, and therefore all the mason of the marble wound up over there. And yeah, that's why it's called Shinar. Sheninaru Mesei Marble, the mason of the marble was shaken out over there. So in general, in many places earlier in the Masechta, also we had, for example, the Gemara had talked about, when it talked about which parts of the world Hashem created Adamarishin from, so it mentioned that his body came from Bavel. In other words, like so to speak, Hashem scooped out a gigantic clod of dirt from Bavel over there to create Adam, and therefore it remained a low-lying area. So we see that the Bavel is called a Metzula, a low-lying, swampy area. Anyway, so far, in other words, understanding the pasuk metaphorically, we're saying that Zechariah is saying, I saw that Hashem was thinking of making the whole world into night, and that Hashem Ish Milchama, was on the red horse representing that the whole world was going to be full of blood. But then Ben Hadassim, Asher Bamitzula, he saw the Hadassim, the Tzaddikim, who were in Mitzula, in Bavel, and therefore Hashem, so to speak, calmed down, and he's not going to destroy the world. Maharsha points out, now, by Kriyas Yamsuf, when we say Hashem Ishmael Chama, Hashem Shmoy, what's the double expression? It means Hashem was showing Gvura and Midas Adin to Mitzrayim, and meanwhile he was showing Rachmim to the Jewish people. So now over here the Midas Adin was in power. So it doesn't even say Hashem's name over here. It just says Vehine Ish Roichev Al Sus Adam, that Hashem was going to exercise his Midas Adin exclusively as Ishmael Chama. Until Hanani Mishael Bar Azariah stood up and did what they needed to do, and then Hashem, so to speak, calmed down and saved the whole world for their sake. You still have later on in the Gemara Megillah, you have a Reb Shimon Ben Yochai has a discussion with his Talmidim where they ask him how come the Jewish people deserved to be destroyed in the times of Achashverosh? Why was there a Gzeira of Haman in the first place? And first they try to say, because they ate from Achashverosh, because Nenu Mesudos Shaloi Serosha, and Reb Shimon tells them, yeah, but that would only apply to the Jews of Shushan, and he explains to them because they had bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. So even though, in other words, Hanani Mishael Bar Azariah saved everybody from destruction at that time, nevertheless there was still a Kitrug on them, which came out years later in Haman's Zero. Anyway, so Miyad, now, so we said that Hashem was, so to speak, riding on a red horse, and we said behind him there were red horses, patchy horses, and white horses. So what does that mean? Miyad Malayim Ruyas Nasim Sukim. So right away, the ones that are full of anger, the red horses that represent a world full of blood, those become now patchy. Ba'adumim, the ones that are full of anger become srukim, they become patchy. Ba'adumim nasim levonim, and the red ones become white, representing like so to speak like you have, for example, on Yom Kippur, when the red string, the Loshon Shel Zahoris would turn white to symbolize that the Jewish people's avedus had been forgiven. The same way over here, the red and patchy horses turn to white when Hashem saw the tzaddikim, and Hashem, so to speak, calmed down and is not going to punish the world anymore. Maharsha brings a girsa that the Radak has an apostic that the black ones became srukim, became patchy, and the red ones became white. So in other words, again, so things are calming down and things are getting back to normal. Amar Papa, so the Papa points out, Shmamina, since you see from this that in Zechariah's vision, that in Zechariah's Nevuah, a white horse represents peace in the world, and the red turned into white, so you see, Susyachivra Malil Chelma. If a person sees a white horse in a dream, then it's a good sign for him. Namely, because a dream, Marsha points out, is 1/60th of Nevuah. So if it was a good thing in Zechariah's Nevuah, that's also a good thing in a dream, which is 1/60th of that. In fact, Marsha points out, the Gemara in Brachas, we have a whole long sugya about things that a person sees in a dream and their significance. The Gemara explains, a white horse is always a good simon, whether it's standing still or whether it's running. As opposed to a red one, is good when it's standing still, but not so good when it's running. So here we're talking about, in other words, if a person sees a red horse running, it's not a good simon. If he was riding on a red horse, as opposed to when a white horse, even if it's running, then it's a good simon. Okay. Next. After the story of Hanani Mishael of Azaria, we have one more pasuk that mentions them. The pasuk says that Nebuchadnezzar hatzlach, he gave them a higher position in the country above all. And then that's it. They disappear and you never hear from them again. So, Rabbanon Mahecha Ozel. So where did the Rabbanon, Hanani Mishael of Azaria, go? We're calling them Rabbanon. Before we had the expression, Al Yishana Adam and Al Rabbanon Shaloi. But after this, they completely disappear. You would think Nebuchadnezzar, again, fine, it says Hatzlach, he gave them Hatzlacha, he gave them like riches or whatever, but you would expect to hear more from them in the king's service, the same way as you hear of Daniel still for years to come. So what happened to them? So where'd they go? Amar Rab, ba'ayin hora mesu. So Rab says they passed away in ayin hora. Everybody is looking at them and gazing, and wow, these are people who were saved by such a tremendous ness. So therefore, that ayin hora killed them. Marsha points out, the Gemara tells us in Bava Metzia that Rav mentions over there, that he says he one time investigated into people's causes of death, and he found 99 out of 100 people die because of an ayin hara. So therefore, he says, Hanani Mishael v'Azaria were susceptible to it as well. The Maharal makes a point. I mean, Daniel was also saved by a nest, but there the nest wasn't as much of a blatant, outrageous one. You could say the lions weren't hungry. Mashenkin over here, nobody who falls into a fire survives it. So therefore, it was a very open, blatant nest, and therefore, Rav is saying that an ayin hara was able to affect them. Shmuel gives a different explanation, but roik tovu, they drowned in spittle. Meaning, Rashi says, we just learned before, that the Goyim were mocking the Jews and saying, Hayitochen, you have such a great God, and you're worshipping Avodah Zarah. So before we said, tofchu al pneim, they were slapping them in the face, but now we're saying also they were spitting at them. In derision. So there was so much saliva that they drowned in it. Now, what does that mean? They literally drowned in spit. So Marsha explains that no. Marsha and on pretty much all the other Mephoshim explain that no. It means metaphorically, the Goyim were humiliating the Jewish people so much, and every time they would see Hanani Mishael v'Azaria, it would evoke that again. Again, it would say, look at these guys who your God saved them, and Hayitochen that you other Jews didn't stand up to it. So every time, then, so now, finally, Hanani Mishael v'Azaria, like they couldn't go on living anymore. Because of them, the Jewish people should have to keep on being humiliated. So therefore, they died because of that. So metaphorically, then the Gemara is calling that they drowned in the spittle, but not literally. They moved to Eretz Yisrael, fine. They didn't want to be anywhere in Nebuchadnezzar's orbit anymore. Who knows what he might come up with next. But they left and they went to Eretz Yisrael. The Nosu Noshim, and they married women, and they married wives, but who lived on of honest, and they had sons and daughters. Shenemar, as we find in another Nevuah of Zechariah, the one that we read it as the Aftarah for Shabbos, for the first Shabbos, for Shabbos Chanukah, or the first Shabbos Chanukah when there were two of them. So we have a pasuk there, Shema no Yeshua HaKohen HaGadol, listen now Yeshua the Kohen Gadol, he was the first Yeshua ben Yehotzadok, was his full name, he was the first Kohen Gadol and the second Lesi Mekdash. So a Malach is telling him in Zechariah's Nevuah, so you pay attention, after Vere'echa HaYoshua Fanecha, you and your friends who are sitting before you, Ki amshe moifes hema, because they are men of moifes, of wonder. So ezer hema noshim shenasalam moifes. Which people do we find in that period where tremendous moifes was done for them? Heviem is a Hanani Mishael v'Azaria. So therefore, so the Navi is addressing Yeshua, and also Hanani Mishael v'Azaria together with them. So the idea is, in other words, like this. So they're answering Moifus. The whole reason they were thrown into the fire, Maharsha explained, was in order that a nes, that a Moifus should happen, as opposed to, the Gemara is going to tell us, Yeshua ben Yitzchak also went through a thing with fire with Nebuchadnezzar, but there it wasn't because of Moifus, there it was because of a different reason, as we're going to learn about soon in the Gemara.
So they were in between the Baisrush and Baisheng?
They were in between, yes. Yeah, so the whole story, okay, so Nebuchadnezzar became king. Nebuchadnezzar first became king 18 years before the Churban. In the first year, of his reign, the Gemara mentions elsewhere, he conquered Nineveh, and that was the end of the empire of Asher. The second year, he conquered Eretz Yisrael and made Jehoiakim his vassal, and then Jehoiakim was loyal to him for a few years and then rebelled, and then Nebuchadnezzar finally came and crushed the rebellion. Then you have him, you have Yechoniah, you have Tzidkiyahu, and then was Churban Bais Rishon. At that point is Nebuchadnezzar's 18th year of his reign. After Nebuchadnezzar lived another bunch of years after that, his reign was like 44, 45 years. After him, he had his son Evil-Merodach. After him, he had his son Belshazzar, and then he's the one who made the party with all the Kalim of the Beis Mikdash and then was killed that night. And then that's it. That's the 70 years of Malchus Bavel are over, and Malchus Paras Amadei begins. Then you have, at the beginning, is when Kodesh made his announcement that they can go build the second Beis Mikdash, and 42,000 Jews went to start, and then the Kusim got involved and mastered on them, and said that they're going to rebel, etc., and therefore the rebuilding was suspended for 18 years. This Nevuah of Zechariah's...
That Kodesh was not related
to Vashti at all. Belshazzar was Vashti's father.
So that Kodesh was Esther's son.
Kodesh, no, that's not the Kodesh who was Esther's son. This is Kodesh, the son-in-law of Daryavish. You have like this, there was Daryavish, the king of Madai. He and Kodesh together conquered the kingdom of Babel and destroyed it. Then you have Daryavish was king for a year or so. He died, was killed in battle or whatever. Kodesh took over, ruled for a couple of years. Then after Kodesh, next you have Ahasuerus, and then you have the second Daryavish, who is also known as Kodesh. Altogether, Jewish history has four kings of the Persian Empire after they destroyed Babel. Secular history has like 10 kings. A huge amount of ink has been spilled about how to reconcile those, but yeah, let's not get into that now, but yeah. In any case, yeah, now here we're talking about the first Kodesh, who he and his father-in-law, Daryavish, helped together, the two of them, overthrew Babel. So Kodesh made this announcement. It was 70 years since Nebuchadnezzar had first conquered Eretz Yisrael and made Jehoiakim his vassal. So Kodesh announced that now all the Jews can go and rebuild the second Beis Mikdash. As it turned out, though, 70 years was actually meant to calculate from the Churban, which was 18 years later, which is why you had that 18-year suspension. The events of Purim all happened during that 18 years. So in short, the story of Hanani Mishael Azariah was during the years after the Churban, during the couple of years after the Churban, they lived long after that, even at the beginning of the second Beis Mikdash, when Zechariah is saying this Nevuah, as they're restarting the rebuilding of the second Beis Mikdash, then he gave this Nevuah, and he's speaking to Yeshua ben Yehoiada and you, and the Re'echa, Yoshua b'Fanecha, which we're saying refers to Hanani Mishael Azariah. In fact, the Medrash says that they went to learn Torah by Yeshua ben Yehoiada. They didn't just move to Eretz Yisrael and start families. They actually became a Talmidim, which is why the Pasuk calls them Re'echa Yoshua b'Fanecha, but they're sitting in front of you as Talmidim sit in front of a Rebbe. So one point is, one interesting point that Mephoshim make is, in other words, we see from this, after all this heroics and after everything, they Taka didn't want to stay in the limelight. They wanted to start. No, they want to have normal lives. They're not going to have, people are going to always look at them and say, look, these are the guys who have this enormous mysterious nefesh. No, they want to live normal lives, a la Torah, a la Avodah, and raising families as Jews have done throughout all the generations. The Maharal gives a whole explanation over here symbolically that he says again that since he had three tzaddikim over here and he relates them to the three midas of chesed, gvura, tiferes, so he has a whole explanation of how the three possibilities of what happened to them, that they died of ayin hara, that they drowned because of the spittle, or that they went to Eretz Yisrael and lived out normal lives, those reflect these three kavim of chesed, gvura, tiferes, respectively. Next, Daniel Lahechan Ozal. Now, where did Daniel go in all this time? In this Omar Rav. So Rav says, L'mithra nahara rabba b'tura or b'tveria. He went to dig a great river in Tveria, or in Tura, where Tura would mean a mountain. Tveria is the name of a city in Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't called Tveria at the time. It got the name Tveria a few hundred, named after one of the Roman emperors, but the Gemara means in the area which nowadays is called Tveria. What was he doing over there, of all things, to dig a canal there? As the Gemara is going to explain in a second, Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel and Hashem all had reasons that Daniel shouldn't be there at the time. So Nebuchadnezzar had used an excuse to send him off to that. Well, Shmuel, Shmuel has a different, Shmuel says a different explanation. Lasuya Bizra de Aspasta. He had gone to get seeds of aspasta, which is a type of grass, a type of herb that is used for animal food. So Rashi says, Hochi Havakim Lahu, each of these Chachamim had learned from their Rebbe that this is what Daniel had been sent on a mission at that point to do. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, and Rabbi Yochanan has a third version that he learned. Lasuya Chaziri de Alexandria Shamitzrayim. He went to get pigs from Alexandria in Egypt. Again, Alexandria itself didn't exist yet, but meaning from that area of Egypt. They were very high quality pigs, and Nebuchadnezzar wanted to start a herd of them someplace else in the world. So the Gemara says, Aini, is that so? How would Daniel have been able to get pigs out of there to establish a breeding stock? Vatanya or Vatnan, we learn in a Mishnah. And Masechta Bechoras, the Gemara discusses over there, the Mishnah discusses over there, is if a female animal is missing its womb, if a female animal has had a hysterectomy, does that make the animal trefa? So we know that there's many internal organs that if they're missing or punctured or whatever, an animal becomes a trefa, does the same thing hold true as far as the womb? So the Mishnah says over there, Todas Haroifereim, Todas Haroifereim, he was a doctor, so he knew these things. He says, I'll prove to you that it doesn't make an animal a trefa. Ain't part of a Chazira Yotzim Alexandria Shemitzrayim, they don't allow the export of any female cow or any female pig out of Alexandria of Egypt, Shein Choskana, Ain Shalom, that they don't first cut out the womb, the uterus, Vishvil Shalai Tailed, so it won't have babies. Precisely because they have these high quality animals over there, they want to keep a monopoly of it. So they won't allow them to be taken out elsewhere. So how would Daniel have been able to do it? And the answer is Zutri Aisi below Datayu. He took out small ones and they didn't realize. Rashi says they didn't realize it's tiny ones and eventually he's going to grow them. So they allowed him to take them out without making do this operation on them. The Yad Ramah says a different way of understanding it. Since they were small, he's able to smuggle them out without them being able to see it. So now, again, the Maharal has a whole explanation over here, also symbolically, that why these three things, that again he says it relates to the three midis of Hanani, Mishael, Azaria, and the three aspects of the nest, and so on and so forth, and therefore he explains in that vein the different explanations of what Daniel was being sent to accomplish. But the point is, all of these are really excuses. I mean, these are not actual reasons to take a high government minister like Daniel and send him off on missions like that. So that's the next piece. The Gemara is going to explain that Nebuchadnezzar need an excuse to get Daniel out of town when all this is happening. As far as, by the way, Mephoshim point out that, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar also ruled over Egypt. He had conquered it a few years earlier. So why does he need to send Daniel on a secret mission to get these things out? Let him march in there and say, I'm on a mission from Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor, and I demand you give me these animals. And the answer is, right here, Nebuchadnezzar didn't want it to be publicly known that he had sent Daniel off. He wanted to send Daniel away, as the Gemara is going to explain, but he didn't want it to be publicly known that he had done that. So therefore, he had to send Daniel incognito. So therefore, Daniel can't march in there and say, I'm under orders from the palace to take these pigs. Therefore, he has to have a way of smuggling them out. And that's what the Gemara says, how he was able to accomplish that. Okay. So the Gemara says, Tanan Abanan, we learn in the Braisa, Shloisha Hoyu Ba'oisa Eitza. There were three people, there were three who were involved, three different minds, one of them Hashem, so, and the other one Mahavdil, human beings, who were involved in that Eitza, that Daniel should not be there at the time when this whole thing with the statue and the Hanani Mishael Vazari happened. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Daniel, and Nebuchadnezzar. Each of them had their own reasons why Daniel shouldn't be there. Namely, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Amar Hashem says, Lezel Daniel Mehocha. Better Daniel should be out of the picture right now. This way people don't think, you know why Hanani Mishael Vazari was saved? Because of the schus of Daniel. People should realize they themselves are great high-level tzaddikim, and they deserve to be saved on their own, not just hanging on Daniel's coattails. So therefore, Hashem wanted to arrange that Daniel shouldn't be there. Now, Daniel said, I should get out of town, delay the Kayim B, because otherwise there might be fulfilled in me, as the Pasuk says, Pskile Elekeim Tisrufun Ba'esh. The Pasuk says you have to burn idols in fire. Now, as the Gemara is going to point out, what happened was, shortly before this story of Nebuchadnezzar and his statue and Hanan Mishal Azariah and all that, is in Daniel Perek Gimel. Meanwhile, in Perek Beis, shortly before that, you have the story with Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that he forgot the dream, and he's threatening to kill all of his wise men if they can't tell it to him, etc., etc. And then Daniel comes and explains the dream to him. And when Nebuchadnezzar heard that Daniel was able to know not only what the dream was, which he himself, Nebuchadnezzar, had forgotten, but even to explain it so clearly, so he was so overawed that he was about to treat Daniel as a god. He bowed to him, he was going to offer korbanos to him. So now Daniel thinks to himself, well, then, in effect, I've been made into a getchka. Now he does stop Nebuchadnezzar right away. The Pasuk only says that he said he's going to do nisochim to Daniel. Daniel stopped him and told him, don't do that. But nevertheless, Daniel is concerned that Nebuchadnezzar has, to a certain extent, made me like a getchka. So now, if there's a fire involved over here for not bowing to the statue, if I get thrown into the fire, maybe I won't have the source to survive it because I've been treated like a getchka. So now he's afraid, and therefore he decided it would be best if he's out of town. Now, Marsha points out that wouldn't be a reason that Hashem shouldn't be there, because certainly Hashem is not going to hold it against him. But Daniel has a concern that sure, b'din shamayim, he'll be sold. B'din shamayim, of course, he'd be saved. But again, Hashem has his own reasons that Daniel shouldn't be there, in order not that people shouldn't think that Hanan, Mishael, and Azariah are just also rans to him. Meanwhile, the Nebuchadnezzar also wanted Daniel out of there. Yezel Daniel Mehacha, let Daniel leave here, delay Lemu, because otherwise people are going to say, Kalyale, the Kei Benura. This Nebuchadnezzar, he threw his own God into the fire. Like this, again, I had just finished worshipping him as a God. Fine, he didn't allow me to, but still, from Nebuchadnezzar's point of view, he had. So now people are going to say, and what? You told Daniel to bow, and of course he's not going to bow either, and when? What, people are going to mock me that yesterday you treated the guy as a God, and today you're throwing him into the fire. So therefore, Nebuchadnezzar figured it's best if Daniel was not in the area. Which, by the way, Marsha brings from Evan Ezra on the Pasuk a much simpler explanation would be once Nebuchadnezzar had treated Daniel that way, then he's not going to order him to bow to the statue in the first place. So what's the problem? He won't order him, Daniel won't refuse, and there won't be any problem of him throwing him into the fire. But Marsha says, very, very well, but not everybody knows that. Nobody else considers Daniel to be a god. So therefore, everybody else is going to think that, hey, you know what, he's not bowing. Let's drag him and schlep him and throw him into the fire, and Nebuchadnezzar might not be able to intervene fast enough. So therefore, said Nebuchadnezzar, figured it's best if Daniel is out of the picture so that we don't have this problem. And where do we see that Nebuchadnezzar, in fact, bowed to Daniel? The Pasuk says, after he interpreted the dream, at that point, King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face in front of Daniel. Daniel sagid, and he bowed to Daniel, and the Pasuk continues, and he said that he's going to bring him a mincha, and he's going to bring him libations to pour in front of him like he would to a getchkin. Which, again, Marsha brings from Evan Ezra. In the simple sense, It may mean in a simple sense that he just gave him presents, but the Gemara is understanding that it means actually that he was going to pour him a libation literally as a getchka. So now, again, Daniel figures what happens, therefore, if there might be some other Averis of mine that might be held against me, and I'm going to end up getting burnt like a getchka does, and Nebuchadnezzar figures Daniel shouldn't be there in the first place, so it's not an embarrassing situation for me. So the bottom line is, therefore, it was agreed by all parties involved that Daniel should not be there. And again, this is why then Nebuchadnezzar found some kind of side mission for Daniel to go on, so that way he'd be out of town. So now the Amoraim argue what exactly it was, but the point, it was definitely not something for Daniel, a high-ranking minister, should be going and doing one of these things, but it was just some sort of picayune thing that he could use an excuse to get him out of town. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Geula, Gimel Elul. We have in the last chapter of Yeshaya, which is Aftodah of Shabbos of Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, we have the expression Ki Kasher Hashemayim Hadoshim VaOretz Hadosha Asher Ani Yoseh. Hashem says, just like the new heavens and the new earth that I'm going to create, the same way Hashem said, which will last forever, the same way Hashem continues Kein Yamid Zarachem V'Shimchem, the same way your descendants and your name of the Jewish people will last forever. Now, what does that mean when we talk about Shemayim VaOretz? What's going to be the Chiddush at that time is even right now, of course, Shemayim Va'aretz are being kept alive because there's a constant infusion of energy of Elikos in them. As Alter Rebbe brings in detail in Shari Yechid V'Emunah, the whole point about that the letters of the words Yehid or Kiyah are constantly in the heaven, and now those letters are constantly a flow of Elikos going through those and keeping the heavens and earth in existence. Now the difference is that Lo Asid Lavoi, that godly energy that brings them Ma'ayin Liyesh constantly, will be openly revealed. So that's the power of Atzmus. This is why the Pasuk says, Asher Ani Oiseh, that I make, in other words, the Ani, the I, the Atzmus of Hashem, is going to be revealed. As in fact, the Altareva points out in Tanya, in Egeres Chof, that the Mohusiv Atzmuseh, the essential essence of Hashem, the Matzol Baruch Hu, that Hashem himself is the only one who has the power to create Yesh from complete Ayin Ve'efes HaMuchlat Mamash. Anyway, a human being can only make, as Altareva points out in several places, can only make one Yesh into another, only Hashem. Only Hashem can turn Ayin into Yesh and constantly infuse it with energy. So therefore, at that point, the entire world will be a Dira Lo Yisbarach, and when you say Lo Yisbarach, means a Dira for Hashem's Atzmos. So meaning, a Dira, like a house of a person. We often translate Dira B'Tachterim as a dwelling place in the lower realms, but I've seen it pointed out. I mean, it's a fancy way of saying it, but what does the word dwelling place mean to an average person? Think of it as more a home. In the sense that when you're at home, you can be yourself. You can do whatever you want. You can be yourself. You can be relaxed. You can be whatever you don't have to be on ceremony in front of everybody. So therefore, when you say that Hashem wants a Dira B'Tachtonim, means that Hashem wants, so to speak, a place, a home where he can, so to speak, kick back and relax and show his complete Atzmus. So that's what it means. Like this, Hashem, in other words, has to show himself to us in various guises. A Dira Lo Yisbarach B'Tachtonim means Hashem doesn't have to show us with any guise. Hashem can show us his actual Atzmus. And therefore, Lo Asid Lavoi, Hashem's, the Ur of Hashem is going to be revealed, as the Alter Rebbe also says in Tanya, without any malbush, without any specific clothing, because in other words, then we'll be able to see the Atzmus itself, just like in your house, there's no particular clothing that you need to wear because you're not showing off to anybody. Okay. Continuing with halachas of tefillin, we've been talking about when you should take off the tefillin. We talked about on regular weekdays, when there's a milah, on days of Kriyas HaTorah, the Chalamoyed, Rosh Chodesh. So now, another din in that connection, we talked about that a person should be that when on a day of Kriyas HaTorah, a person should keep on his tefillin until after the Sefer Torah is brought back to the Aron Kodesh. Suppose a person is taking off his tefillin beforehand, for whatever reason. So then he shouldn't do it right in front of the Sefer Torah. He should turn to a side because the kovod of the Sefer Torah should not be any less than the kovod of his Rebbe. And a Talmud is not supposed to take off his tefillin in front of his Rebbe, as we will learn in a later siman. As in fact, actually, we're going to have later on in our parak as well, the Gemara is going to point out about Yeravam with Shloima, where at one point the Gemara says, Cholat tefillah b'fanav, that Yeravam took off his tefillin in front of Shloima, and that was considered a big chutzpah. And it was considered Hedim Yod Bamelach. He lifted a hand in rebellion against the king. By doing that, how you talk and you take off your tefillin in front of your Rebbe, which Shloima was the Rebbe of the whole Jewish people. So in the same vein over here, then a person should not be taking off his tefillin right in front of the Sefer Torah. He should, even if he has to take them off early, he should turn away to a side and then take them off. Okay, and we could start one more halacha, I guess. Siman Chavav is the dinim about if a person only has one of the two tefillin. So if a person only has one, Shoyad or Shorosh, you put on the one that you have and you make a bracha on it, because as we've learned before, every one is its own individual mitzvah, and they're not ma'akev one another, so that even though you're supposed to put on the Shoyad and then the Shorosh, but if you only have one, then you put on the one. The same thing, if you have both of them, but there's some kind of onus where you can only put on one, then you put on whichever one you can, and you make a bracha, and you make the appropriate bracha, or brachos on it, as the case may be.
Yeah, that definitely comes into play.
So when does it happen that a person is only willing to do one tefillah?
Someone's in a big hurry. I think my son says, "We'll just put a shel rosh on the other guy."
Interesting. Okay.